Good morning, Ozark. All right. Let's just admit there's only like three of you out there that actually know who I am, but that's okay. You will have to suffer with my suffering voice today, so that is your pain for today, but we will make it through because God has a word for you today. I love being a dad. I love it with all my heart, and one of my first conversations with Amanda before we got married, she asked me how many kids I'd like to have one day, and I responded with a sensible number. I said, I'd like to have three. But because I'm reasonable and I know that marriage takes two, I said, but I would be open to maybe a fourth. How many would you like to have? She responded back to me with, I want eight. And after 16 years, we have six, with a seventh coming on the way this year, this next year, Lord willing. We see who actually won that conversation. I love my kids. I love being a dad. It's one of my pursuits, one of my passions in life, to be a good father. It means a lot to me, and because I'm passionate about being a father, because I'm passionate about being a dad, I want to watch out for them. I want to do what's best for them, and I was thinking about that earlier this year. My oldest is a freshman in high school, and she plays on the tennis team. Earlier this season, she had an away match, and we traveled there, and we watched her, and after it was all over, I heard some of the girls say to her, there was some boy who put a tennis ball in your bag. Well, I heard that. So we go back, we get into the car, all the kids are buckled up, we end up taking off down the road, and of course, the only thing we care about is, what's in your tennis bag? She reaches in, she pulls out a tennis ball, and she said, you've got to be kidding me, there's a phone number on it. This began a great long debate, a lot of conversation in our car with my boys in the back who just make me so proud. They came up with wonderful ideas like, burn it, Dad. The other one had another good idea. He said, why don't we roll down the window and we'll just chuck it out the window. And I was like, that's not bad. My wife, being the more sensible one in the family, she was trying to change the conversation into a different subject. And she was like, it's not that big of a deal. Let's just calm down. But I had my own idea. I said, why don't you give me the ball? I'll keep it. I look over at my wife, and she looks at me, and she gives me that look that, of course, that I know after all these years. And it's the look like, I know what you're thinking. And I don't like it. And so I look at her and I said, what? She says, you better not call that number. And I was like, honey, I would totally do something like that. Because for me, I mean, obviously, if a young man is going to put a ball with his phone number in the bag of my daughter's tennis back after a match, surely he must be a tennis coach. So I need to find out if he's a legit tennis coach. Needless to say, after I called the young man, he was not a tennis coach. What do you pursue in your life today? What does your heart beat after? Our theme is about how to lead and to live in exile. We are called to live in this world, but not to be a part of it. There's tension in that, isn't there? Jesus prayed this in John 17, 14 to 16, and if we were to be honest, this is perhaps one of the most difficult aspects of our faith journey. I know it is for me as we're surrounded as Christians in a world and its cultures which oppose us because it first opposed him. So how do God's people live, navigate, and not fit into a world filled with so much promiscuity, self-indulgence, idolatry, pride, hatred, fear, and so much more? Our culture today seems to mirror the wickedness of men in Noah's day, the sins of Sodom, the idolatry in Athens, and the list of grievous sins in Romans chapter 1. Is there any hope for God's people to live and to lead in a world like this? Simple answer is yes. Yes, of course. But it will be difficult. This morning, we're going to take a look at the example of Daniel, an incredible, incredible guy. And you could pull out so many different examples from his life and from the book of Daniel of a guy who was living in exile in extremely difficult circumstances, and yet he remained faithful, and yet he remained strong. Today, we're going to look at one of these examples from Daniel chapter 6, verses 1 through 11. This kind of transitional passage that takes place here where the power of Babylon is gone, and now you have the Medes and the Persians, and King Darius is on the throne. But specifically, in looking at Daniel's life, what he did in this example helped him to lead and to live in a culture which was in opposition to God and to his faith. And so this morning we're going to take a look at three principles from the text, three areas of how you and I can lead and live in this life while not becoming a part of it. And the first one is this. The first point is that you must know integrity. You must know integrity. In verses, starting in verse 1 through verse 5, it says, "It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom. With three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel, the satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the entire kingdom. At this, the administrators and satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither was corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, 'We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God.'" I like a real basic understanding of integrity, and I've heard it said this way, that integrity is defined as what you see is what you get. I kind of like that. I'm a simple guy. What you see is what you get. There's nothing hidden. All is transparent, all is genuine, and this is Daniel. Daniel, a man who no fault could be found. Daniel, at this point, I'm sure was going, "Really? Really? More troubles, more strife, more problems in my life?" At this point, he would have been in his 80s. He's experienced all kinds of things, being taken from his home in Judah, placed in the service of King Nebuchadnezzar. He's then transitioned to Belshazzar, and he saw Babylon get overthrown. And now he's in the service of Darius the Mede, who was king over Babylon, while Cyrus II was king of Persia. This guy has seen it all, and he is old, and he's going, "Really?" Daniel quickly proves his value in the text to Darius, who observes Daniel's high integrity, his competency, and he wants to appoint him over all the other officials in the kingdom. One of the most important aspects of these verses, though, is I want you to not overlook how important it was that Daniel was in the world. How important it was that he was in the world. Daniel has been educated from chapter 1 in a pagan culture, pagan education. He serves in high political offices and is surrounded by evil people, practices, and idols everywhere you look. Yet God placed him in this position to be an influence. Can God use secular education and or place you and me in secular positions to influence culture? Does God only work in the pews of a church, or does he also work in the halls of Congress? Psalm chapter 24. Psalm 24 says that the earth is the Lord's. The earth is the Lord's. Everything is his. He cares about all things that are happening in this life and everything that happens in this world because it is all his. Romans chapter 13, verse 1 tells us that God cares so much about what happens politically that he actually places people in those positions of power. He cares. How can we, as God's people, stress and try to reach a lost and dying culture with the message of the cross unless we engage it better and understand it as Daniel does in the text here? John Stott actually calls this double listening. And it's the value that we have when we live in the world. Yet note at the same time how Daniel is not of the world. In this environment, Daniel maintained a high integrity, which is what sets him apart. It's his integrity that really sets up the whole sequence of events that unfolds in this chapter, from his fellow leaders who scheme to remove him from their path, to the king who is so consumed with himself and his ego that he sets himself up as the only God to pray to, ultimately culminating in the lion's den and the king eventually glorifying God at the end of the chapter. It's Daniel's integrity. It's Daniel's integrity. Even with accusations against him, doesn't matter. Without integrity, we undermine any chance we have to be any real influence, because we would simply be like everybody else in the culture. Whereas by being different, events will unfold that give us an opportunity to have a genuine and far-reaching influence for good, even if it costs us something. So here's the importance. Here's to the importance of maintaining our integrity, because in a fallen world, integrity is more or less a synonym for not being of the world. Is what others see what they get with you? When they watch your life, when they listen to you speak, when they look at where you go and the friends that you have, is what they see what they get with you? Or is there something more? Is there something hidden? Are we genuine and authentic where no fault can be found like in Daniel's life? If we're to live in this world but not be of it, integrity must be maintained. The second point this morning that we'll look at from the text, the first one is to know integrity. The second way that we can live in this world but not be of it is to know your enemy. To know your enemy. In verses 4-9, we'll read it again. At this, the administrators, satraps, tried to find grounds or charges against Daniel and his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt or negligent. Finally, they said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the laws of his God." So these administrators, satraps, went to the king as a group, and they said, "May King Darius, may you live forever." The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors, they all gathered together, minus Daniel. "We've all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce a decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, will be thrown into the lion's den." And you can almost see Darius kind of nodding in approval of this, because they say, "Now, your majesty, issue the decree, put it into writing so it cannot be altered. In accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed, so King Darius put the decree in writing." There was a woman who went out the door to go shopping, and before she did, her husband told her as she was walking out the door, "Don't you buy any expensive dresses." His wife turned around and said, "Well, what if I find one that I really like?" Her husband replied to her, "Just say, 'Get behind me, Satan.'" A couple of hours later, the wife came back home and she had a very new and very expensive dress. Her husband was furious and he said, "What did I tell you?" "Well," his wife said, I saw this dress and I really wanted to try it on. So I took it, I went into the dressing room and I put it on and I looked in the mirror and it was so beautiful and I really wanted it. But then I remembered what you said. So I said, "Get behind me, Satan." The husband looked at her and he said, "Then why did you buy the dress?" She said, "Well, because then I heard him say, 'Well, it looks good from behind here too.'" Satan. Come on. He's really not all that dangerous, is he? I mean, he's actually more bark than he is bite, right? There's all kinds of modern concepts of the enemy that I even saw some advertisements more recently of a smiling devil doll, which was disturbing because it was a blend of like a Cupid doll with a tail and a pitchfork. I don't know how that works. But actually today, in fact, you can purchase soft, cuddly devils for your children to sleep with. Beanie Babies actually make one if you're interested. And we can fall prey to this sometimes, can't we? Our enemy, because he is God's enemy, wants to make himself seem like he's no threat to us and no threat to this world. 2 Corinthians 11:14 tells us that Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. He puts on a mask to hide his true intentions, his true nature, in order to deceive us into thinking he's not so dangerous or as involved in this world as he truly is. But make no mistake, he is behind the evils in our culture. Luke chapter 4, verse 6, when Satan is tempting Jesus, Satan offered him the kingdoms of this world. Why would he offer him something if his fingers weren't directly involved in them? His fingerprints are all over the place. He's the figure in the shadows who smiles when a child is kidnapped and sold and trafficked. He's the one in the locker room who is applauding. He's applauding when boys are bullying an easy target. He is in the backseat of a car nodding when the window is rolled down and hateful and harmful words are yelled at children who are of a different color or are disabled. He's in the front row with politicians when a bill is signed that it is okay for more children to be killed within the womb of their mothers. He is present and pleased when harmful and addictive drugs are passed out and is used. And he was the puppet master influencing the satraps and these in power to devise a plan to take down God's prophet, God's man, like he does in Job. He is behind it all. His language is death. His methods are destructive and evil. And if pleasure can be felt by him, then it is felt when we experience pain, when we fail. When we doubt, he is without question the worst, and he is real, and he has his sights set on you and me. From the government leaders scheming how to take Daniel out of the picture in verses 4 and 5 to their deceitful proposition to King Darius, as well as Darius's adjustment of the laws to boost himself into a God-type status, because ultimately, isn't that what we really want? We want more power, we want more attention, we want more fame. We ultimately, at the bottom of it all, what do we really want? We want to be God. Just like the deception Satan presented in the garden with Eve is the same deception we see here in Daniel chapter 6. And don't fool yourself into thinking it's not the same deception that we can fall into today and that we struggle with. I found it fascinating. I read an article from Time Magazine in 1972 that was written about Satan worshipers in the occult. They described in that article, and they said this, I quote, "They invoke Satan not as a supernatural being, but as a symbol of man's self-gratifying ego, which is what they really worship. They look down on those who actually believe in the supernatural, evil or otherwise." What does that tell you? What does that tell you? That tells you this, that he is the great deceiver. He deceives us all, fooling people into thinking he's not a threat. Our enemy will stop at nothing to stop the Lord and the Lord's people. Pay attention to the extremes that he is willing to go, even within the text here. He orchestrated a scheme which impacted an entire kingdom to destroy one man of faith. What extremes do you think he will go to come after you and to come after me? So if you're a man or woman of faith surrounded by an alien culture, but you're different from it because you follow Christ, you should expect that he will be coming after you. But take heart. Because greater is he that is in you than he that is in this world. But in order to live in this world and not become of it, we need to know who our enemy is and the ways in which he is working. And the third point this morning, the third and final point this morning, if you're going to live in this world but not be of it, you need to know courage. Need to know courage. In verses 10 and 11, it says, "Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows were open towards Jerusalem. And three times a day, he got on his knees and he prayed, giving thanks to God just as he had done before. And these men went as a group and they found Daniel praying and asking God for help." When we lived overseas, it was nothing for me to hear my wife scream. She did it quite often, actually, and anytime she would see a centipede or a lizard crawling across the floor, it was not good. On one occasion, while we were in Barbados, I was outside with my two older boys, and we were working on something. I don't even really remember what we were doing, but I heard this loud scream come from within the house, and I thought, oh boy, here it comes. And it followed up by this yell of saying, "Someone come kill this thing." So I got up and I started to go into the door, but I felt this hand grab me by the arm, and it was the hand of one of my boys. And they both looked at me with unwavering confidence, and they said, "Don't worry, Dad. We'll get it." I can't help but I felt so much pride swell up inside of me that I couldn't help but for a grin to come over my face. These boys are going to roll up their sleeves and put on their game faces and go into battle against the Jurassic Park freak of nature, centipede, that was scaring our family's damsel in distress with nothing but grit and a sandal. I was so very proud. They went inside, and I overheard them hatching their plan of how they were going to take on their foe. This centipede had no chance. They ran down the hallway and they went into the bedroom, and in record time of mere seconds, they came running back out of the bedroom and back out the hallway, but not in victory. Instead, they were screaming and shaking their heads. They said, "No way, Dad, it's way too big. You got this one." Oh, Christian, how's your courage? What was Daniel's response to the news of the law which commanded him to pray to the king? He didn't change anything he was doing or introduce anything new which wasn't already a part of his life and custom. Which is one of the most assured ways to know that we are not of the world is what we do when the pressure comes. We continue to do that which we have already been doing, even under scrutiny, even if it costs us personal endangerment. So Daniel does this. He goes into his home and he opens his windows towards Jerusalem, no doubt remembering Solomon and his words when dedicating the temple in 1 Kings 8, 46 to 51 to pray towards the land and the city God had chosen and the temple Solomon built for his name. But in that passage, I can't help but wonder. I can't help but wonder if verses 41 to 43, which speak of God's heart for the nations, and specifically, I can't help but wonder if verse 43 was in the front of Daniel's mind, which says, "Do whatever the foreigner asks of you, so that all the peoples of earth may know your name and fear you, as do your people Israel." I wonder when Daniel prayed for help, if Daniel was praying for strength, praying to God and saying, "God, may this king and may this nation know you and know of your power and know of your great name. God, if you're going to use me, please use me in this great service so that your name may be glorified in this pagan nation. God, if you're going to use me, please use me in this way. Help me, Lord. I wonder. Because after Darius can't sleep at night and he comes to Daniel in the lion's den and he recognizes in verses 26 and 27, he recognizes Daniel's faithfulness and he gives praise to God. King Darius, who said, I am going to be the God over all this land for the next 30 days, is the same pagan guy who in verses 26 and 27 say this about our God, for he is the living God. And he endures forever. But this witness would have never happened if he had kept his window closed. Daniel could have just prayed privately to himself and tried to balance the edict of the king while also trying to be faithful to the Lord. But as loyal as Daniel was to the state, he was always more loyal to God. So he opens his windows towards Jerusalem to connect himself with the God of the universe. And Christopher Wright said it this way, that he opened the windows not to let Daniel's prayers out as much as it was to let the God of Jerusalem in. This wasn't an escape hatch for Daniel. This wasn't a last resort. This was his first priority. This was an invitation to the Lord to help, to enter and to help give Daniel the courage to face whatever he may be confronted with as a result of this new law. So Daniel opens his windows and he prays three times a day and he gets down on his knees. It's interesting to me. Daniel is a man who has stood shoulder to shoulder with the most powerful kings in the world. He has sat around banquet tables fit for royalty. He has walked in the halls of the most powerful men in the world, but he only kneels before one. Dale Ralph Davis said, kneeling in prayer is not a matter of indifference. It reminds you of your true position. It's as if you say, I'm a servant. He is a king. I do not live in a democracy, but under a monarchy. He is not my errand boy. I never present my demands. I am always a beggar at the throne of grace. And even though it is a throne of grace, I never forget that it is a throne. Courage, Christians, begins in prayer. Courage begins on our knees. So what would our response be if we could not worship, read, pray, and know God publicly? Do we have the courage of Daniel in our faith to continue going on, continue pushing forward, because that's who we are and that's what we do? Living as exiles in foreign cultures takes courage. But it begs the question, after I read through all of this, it begs the question, how? How did he do this? He's an old man now. How did he go through this from the beginning to this point and even more later on in his life? How did he remain faithful through this another trial in his old age? Because I want to do that in my own life. Daniel was in exile in life, not only living as a Jew in Babylon, not only from a cultural standpoint. Daniel could have remained in Jerusalem, he could have been in Babylon, or he could have been somewhere else in the world. I mean, basically, Daniel spent his whole life as an exile in a cross-cultural environment. Same like you and me today, we live in a cross-cultural environment, is what Peter says in 1 Peter 2:11. But from chapter 1 through his entire story, the key to it all, the hope that he had was this: Daniel passionately pursued God. He passionately pursued God, and it's his constancy in maintaining and building on that relationship over a lifetime which developed integrity, taught him to identify the enemy's plans, and built up his courage for moments just like this. And if your identity in life and your pursuit in life remains in him, you too will be able to live and lead successfully in this world while not becoming a part of it. I can't help, when I think of this, thinking of a couple friends of mine who are from Haiti. They were born and raised into families that were witch doctors. Some were just a father, and some were actually a mother and father. And they were taken to all of the events and all of the happenings that they would do as a practicing witch doctors, and they would beat the drums, and they would watch evil spirits enter people, and they were a part of this. And they were being groomed to take over these roles. But then they heard the message of Jesus. And they came to faith in him, and they were baptized into Christ, and they began a new journey with Jesus. But they still had to go home at night. And they still had to see what was happening within the evils of their family and within the evils of their culture. So what do you do with that? Well, it was encouraging. It was encouraging because you saw them remain faithful because of their commitment and desire to follow the Lord was more important. It was their pursuit of their life. I think of another young man that we mentored in St. Vincent who came from an impoverished neighborhood where every, and I mean literally every 11 and 12-year-old girl was pregnant in that neighborhood. And every other 10 to 12-year-old young man was participating in sexual activity as well, except him. He had given his life to Christ, and he was learning what it meant to follow Jesus, and not only was he remaining pure himself, but he was encouraging the other young men in his neighborhood that you can do this too, and this is what life should look like for you. Come know my Jesus. Come know my Jesus. It's not easy. It's not easy to not become a part of the world. But it is possible when you know the Lord and you find him to be the pursuit of your life and of your heart. Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 13, very famous verse, fittingly says, "You will seek me and you will find me when you seek me with all your heart." I really appreciate how Eugene Peterson said this. He said, yes, when you get serious about finding me, when you get serious, Ozark Christian College, when you get serious, Christian, when you get serious about finding me, and you want it more than anything else in this life, I'll make sure that you won't be disappointed. Pursue him. He won't disappoint.